What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, an affiliate of Mad in America Radio, broadcasting on KBOO in Oregon, sponsored by Portland Hearing Voices and the Icarus Project, and syndicated on the Pacifica Network. Madness Radio is online at kboo.fm/madnessradio and at madinamerica.com. Welcome to Madness Radio. This is your host, Will Hall. Today, my guest is Olga Runciman. Olga is a psychiatric nurse in Denmark who has worked in long-term psychiatric care institutions. She's also a psychiatric survivor diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia, and today she works as a psychologist in private practice. So welcome to Madness Radio, Olga Runciman.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me, Will.
You and I have been colleagues through the Hearing Voices movement for many years, and we both work with the Institute for Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, which is based in Sweden. I just saw you recently in Sweden, so it's really nice to finally get a chance to do this interview with you.
Yes, I'm really happy that you've invited me.
Today's topic, we want to kind of focus on the fact that both of us are in this very seemingly unlikely position of being diagnosed with schizophrenia and now working as therapists, which I think is really interesting because it really defies a lot of the expectations and the stereotypes and the stigma. I want to get into, you know, how do we do therapy differently and what is an approach to work as a therapist that's actually compassionate and caring and different, and how is it different than a lot of what is out there? Okay, maybe you can just give us a little bit of a capsule summary. How did you get this? I mean, I guess that's kind of like the worst diagnosis that you can have, paranoid schizophrenic. I mean, that's like horror movies and, you know, serial killers. I mean, that's the worst sort of label that can be put on someone. How did you end up getting that diagnosis?
Well, so very briefly, I've heard voices all my life. I struggled. I've had lots of things happen to me, like so many others, of traumatic characters. I've been abused, sexually abused, all bullied. I've been sent off at the age of 8 to a boarding school, which is where the abuse occurred, and things like that. So I have that story, and I developed voices from a very early age. I managed to, survive, and they were actually helping me. I didn't understand them, but I always view them, and now today when I do understand them, I see that they kept me alive, actually, even though they became abusive themselves. I moved to Denmark, and then I became a nurse, and I became a psychiatric nurse, and was working there, and I remember some things, you know, like other people would hear voices, but they were always schizophrenics. So I used to think to myself, well, how can I be a nurse and hear voices, you know, if that's absolutely the definition of schizophrenia? And of course, I saw the lives that they, you know, were doomed to, and I used to think, oh my God. And so I, of course, didn't mention one single word about hearing voices. But, you know, there was things, the trauma was popping up. I was beginning to get many flashbacks because I was actually in a good space, and I think perhaps I was ready, or, you know, there was sort of peace to maybe go inwards, even though I didn't feel I chose that. So I started to get many flashbacks. The voices became increasingly bad. I was also living very isolated. I'd be with people, but I didn't share anything about myself. I was very protective of myself. I was very, you know, I was a helper, and you can always hide behind a helper. Many people don't realize how little you actually share of yourself when you go into the helping role, as I did as a nurse. I found also that I didn't want help from the system. I knew I needed some help, but I didn't know where to go. And I discovered at the same time that I was working within a system that I didn't want to use. And that was actually really shocking to me, but it was absolutely crystal clear I didn't want to do that. So like many people, I dragged it out, and I got worse and worse and worse, and I ended up in the well, we call it a closed ward. I think in the UK it's section, but you know, the doors are locked, you can't get out. I remember meeting the psychiatrist who locked me up, who was looking at me and said, Olga, I'm sorry, you have schizophrenia. And I said, no, I don't. And then he said that that's part of my my illness, this denial of the fact that I had this illness.
Lack of insight. Yeah, it's like one of the clinical characteristics of, yeah, we're going to get into that because that's a that's a powerful, powerful moment of one authority trying to dominate you and you saying no, and then they kind of win at that moment.
Precisely, because all it is words. You know, the Foucauldian gaze or whatever one wants to look at it. I mean, he had an authority to say that. And by saying, you have schizophrenia, my life changed completely. It's truly like being cursed in the olden days.
Like being cursed. That's absolutely right. It's like casting a spell on someone.
Yes.
You actually were working as a psychiatric nurse before you were hospitalized, but you had this experience of voices and you had this abuse history. And then that's so just tragic that because you saw how people were treated, you avoided treatment that just ended up making things worse because there was nowhere else to go to. And the voices, I guess the paranoid part is when you hear voices and the voices are attacking you or coming after you, or you have what are called command hallucinations or command voices. They're telling you to do things. Is that what got you the kind of the paranoid cherry on the schizophrenia cake, in a sense? Because that's sort of like, it doesn't get lower than that with the paranoid schizophrenic diagnosis.
No, I of course never believed I was paranoid. I thought it was very sensible, but I did have experiences that when I look back on it, I can see that they were perhaps a little bit extreme. I remember one time when I was so fearful, because that's, for me, paranoia has got a lot to do with fear. And I was very frightened, and I wanted some help, and I couldn't go to the psychiatrics. This was before I got admitted. And I knew I needed some help, and I went out onto the street, and I stopped the buses, there's mostly buses, not that many lorries, but I was stopping them, and mainly because they were big and I needed some big help. And then this puny little man would come out, which was the driver, you know, didn't fit in with this, you know, my idea of big, and I'd say, oh, you're the wrong person, and move them on. So I did do things like that. And I also had, my voices would always tell me not to trust people, which was also deemed as, you know, I'd become wary and careful about what I'd say, which of course also adds to the label. On the other hand, I think there's many good reasons to do so, and I still see that, and I still believe that. I mean, you're surrounded by a system that's insisting that you view yourself in a particular way, which didn't make sense to me.
Yeah, the system that wants to curse you and actually put you in this frame of mind that's going to be harmful for you. So you were going out into the street and stopping big trucks as part of wanting to get help. And it makes so much sense when you explain it in retrospect. Well, I just wanted help and I knew I needed big help, so I went after. But that's also, I mean, that's the kind of thing that once it gets put into a kind of a clinical soundbite, I mean, you're all done. Oh, you were running in traffic. You could have been killed. You were a danger to yourself. And you also, you know, you said something really interesting before. You know, you said that now you see your voices as protective, and that they actually came to you out of these abuse experiences, and that actually they were quite hurtful and aggressive and demanding, but ultimately they were protective. And I think that's also a really important thing for people to understand, that you're someone, I mean, I think this is also true of myself, that we're kind of at the end of a very long road. We still have a long to go, and it's a continuing journey, but we change our relationship to these experiences. So maybe in the past you were more afraid of your voices, and now you more value them. Do you still hear voices today? Is this something that you still experience today?
Yes, I still hear my voices, and I'd be actually really upset if they went away. They're definitely not as dominant or as loud or in any way, because I have a rich life now, but they're still present. They've changed character in many ways. They've actually become more talking amongst themselves.
That would be very similar to my experience. I mean, I know that there are certain situations that I get into that the voices kind of one very aggressive, demonic voice that will come. And I can really understand. It makes sense that it's in these kinds of situations. And I also have some positive voices. I mean, I often tell the story of, you know, that the is it a positive voice or is it a negative voice? Is it a protective voice or is it an abuser voice is sometimes a little hard to understand. Because, I mean, when I was in San Francisco many, many years ago and I was in a really bad, really bad state, I wouldn't leave my apartment and I was very frightened and really struggling. And I remember I had been crying on the floor of my bathroom and suddenly I heard this very loud voice say, "You are going to die if you don't do yoga." And that was when I, you know, I had known about yoga. I had some yoga books, but I never really, and that's when I started my yoga practice. And so, you know, was that a negative voice or a positive voice? Well, it was very threatening, but actually it had my own best interest at heart. So you got out of the hospital and then you kind of recovered your career as a psychiatric nurse?
Well, I spent 10 years in the psychiatric system and I became deemed as a chronic incurable schizophrenic and I was put on the highest disability that we have here in Denmark because they deemed me to be incapable of even earning even pocket money.
Wow, Olga, it just gets worse and worse. So you're not only diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia, not only were you running in the streets in front of trucks, but you were actually considered a chronic, you know, incurable schizophrenic. You defy every stereotype about what's possible out there for people like us.
Yeah. And so I was lost in there for 10 years. The reason I came out actually was because I decided I truly couldn't live this life. I believed all the hopelessness, the stories of hopelessness, and that I must live with this. Because during those 10 years, you know, I initially started out saying I didn't have it, and I, you know, but you become, or you, I can't say, I became in a way colonized. I don't know if that's the right word.
Colonized, yeah. I think colonized makes a lot of sense, yeah.
And I ended up truly believing that I was ill and I had this incurable brain disease. I was also confused about the drugs, which is also something I talk a lot about nowadays with students, nursing students, because, for example, I couldn't believe that the drugs I was giving people when I was working as a psychiatric nurse had such devastating impact. So when I was taking it, many of those drugs and cocktails, it never occurred to me that it was the medication that was also making me absolutely a vegetable, a zombie, you know.
You were taking antipsychotics. Well, which antipsychotics had you taken?
Oh, I've taken many of them during the 10 years, and on top of each other, I also took antidepressants. I took benzos. I was never given any of the bipolar ones, you know, the lithium kind, but we use antipsychotics also for people who get labeled bipolar. So I've tried a lot of them.
And so at some point you just said, I'm done. This hasn't helped me. I'm moving on.
Because I believed it all and I believed I was truly ill and I was in so affected by the drugs and everything, I decided to commit suicide. And I planned that down to the very last detail. And then I was writing a letter to my family because I knew that no matter what, and it was important to me to try and explain why I truly couldn't have this life. It was the most important turning point for me. I did write, I have tried everything. And there was something about that in that fog of zombie land that I kept returning to it. And then I realized I hadn't done what I would do. And that changed it all because I thought, you know, of course, when I used to, in the beginning, I used to say, well, I'm a psychiatric nurse, so I know. And they would look at me and say, Olga, you're not a nurse anymore. And you won't be a nurse anymore. You know, you have to accept your illness. But anyway, I put myself as that sort of a nurse. And I thought, what would I do for, you know, this person there, Olga? that I was looking down on. And I made a plan, and that plan actually worked. And what my plan, just very briefly, was I wanted to have therapy. I'd been told all the years that I'd been in the psychiatric system that as a schizophrenic, therapy would be detrimental. In fact, I'd get it even worse. So that was not an option for me. I wanted to lose weight. I'd put on tons of weight, like so many people had, you know, sort of just that. I'd always dreamt of being an astronomer. I wanted to study the stars, astronomy, nothing to do with nursing or anything. And I found this course in the planetarium, which actually brought my spirituality back, that course, which was very important in my healing process. And and then getting off the drugs. So I did that, and I woke up, and I re-engaged with society. And it took, I still believed, and I had my suicide plan there because I truly believed I was still ill, and it took a while. But then I went to a conference where this person was speaking about recovery and said that if you looked at it through the eyes of a lived experience, he knew many that had recovered. And suddenly this idea that there was no evidence for an illness, and basically I jumped at that because I'd been every time I got an anxiety attack or something, I'd think, oh my God, is this illness returning, right? So when this person stood up there on the stage and talked about recovery in 2005, I think it was, we're talking quite a number of years ago now, I thought, oh my gosh. I then and there chose that direction.
I really encourage people to, you know, listen to your story more in depth on the Mad in America website. I mean, that's a powerful moment and says a lot about both suicide and about, you know, how, and I think I work in a very similar way, how we work as therapists today. Your suicide note says, I can't have this life. I've tried everything. And then you realize, wait a second, I haven't tried what I would offer myself as a nurse, as a healer, as a helper. I hadn't drawn on my own resources. And then just the light bulb goes off. And what I've seen, because I've struggled a lot with suicidal feelings, and that was one of the things that got me first locked up, was that it really is a strong message inside of you that says, I can't have this life. It's not, I don't want life. It's more like, I don't want this life. I want a different life, whether it's a life that doesn't have as much pain, or whether it's a life that has my dreams back alive and possible, whether I want a life of my career or my spirituality or my relationships, or just wanting a different life. And then having exhausted everything and then realizing, wait a second, there's this one thing I haven't tried. And I think that I would say that's probably one of the key things that makes my work different than a lot of the therapists out there, I think, is that I start with, what would I want? What would I want in this situation? Let me try that. What would be helpful for me? Maybe not. Maybe it's not going to be helpful for this person. Everybody's different. But at least to be able to put myself in the other person's position, I think, is a very valuable thing that doesn't come from books and clinical skills training. It actually comes from your personhood and what you've been through. And have you been through suffering? And can you relate? And can you put yourself in the other person's position? So is that something you find yourself doing a lot with the clients you work with now as a therapist?
Yes, very, very much. So I'm very open about the fact that I've been labeled. I make a lot of fun with it. You know, humor is always a good thing. So I absolutely try and put myself into other people's shoes. I often find when I'm working that I'm listening. But I actually have a whole listening system, which is my body, like an antenna, I kind of see. And I believe that my antenna were developed because of my life. I had to really get really attuned to the world around me because it was really dangerous at times. So I had to learn to read the signs. So I learned to read when people would say something, but there'd be something that I'd pick up that know that the words are not to be listened to. I must listen to something else. So I've used that very much.
That really resonates with me. I grew up in a family situation that was really chaotic, and my father was always very unpredictable. My mother often as well, but I never knew whether the sweet, kind father was going to come or the scary monster was just going to, you know, scream at me. And so, yeah, it was about not just listening to the words that he said, but all the signs and the cues and the body language and the, you know, that sensitivity. I think for a long time for me was pathologized. Oh, that's part of paranoia.
Exactly.
That's part of, and I would see and feel things that other people weren't talking about. And if I tried to talk about them, they would get defensive or they would say it's not there or this is just in my head. But actually now, you know, I feel the same way you do, that it's actually an asset as a therapist to just really to read the signs and to notice on a very subtle level. And I think that also we underestimate the way that our bodies and our minds and our hearts attune with each other. And so when I sit down with someone, I really am like, you know, allowing myself to enter their world. And if I can be sensitive enough and open enough, the feelings that they're having, I'll have reflections of them and resonance of them inside of myself. And so if my gut is telling me something, or I'm distracted by something, or I'm feeling irritation or fear, then I start to think, well, wait a second, how does this maybe fit in to what the other person is going through? What does it show me? It's not just
exactly.
It's not just push it aside and hold on to my professional demeanor, but really allow myself to kind of enter into this mix with the other person, because you really are, it's a relationship. You're really in there with the other person. You really are.
Absolutely. And in fact, that's one of the things that I prioritize and always state, that for me, the most important thing is establishing a relationship. And that can sometimes take a while, but the initial first meeting is usually very, very indicative of that there's a potential to build upon it. Because one thing is to have, you know, a sense of, okay, here, there, you know, I might be able to speak with her, but it still takes time often with trust issues and stuff to be sure. But so I really spend a lot of time with that, because I think creating also healing relationships, because many people, especially when you've been deemed psychotic or schizophrenic and stuff like that, you tend to lead a very isolated life. You know, you become excluded from society, living on the fringes. There's so many things in that. So, and to have a meaningful relationship, even though it's a therapeutic one, is very healing.
It's crucial, and that's just not offered as the kind of the standard care. Is how is the pharmacology going to affect your brain? That's the question, not how can we put you into healing relationships with people. And I think that's really, really crucial. And I think that often because of the wounding behind the mistrust and the wounding behind the kind of the suspicion or paranoia that it gets called, you know, people are really on guard against anything that's coming at them. And so, like, for example, like I noticed that when I work with families and I'm meeting them in person, and the father will come in and he'll look me straight in the eye and he'll say hello and he'll shake my hand. And then the mother will step in and she'll look me straight in the eye and say, hello, Mr. Hall, and shake my hand. And then maybe the son comes in and he's not saying anything. He doesn't extend his hand. He doesn't make eye contact. And in that moment, I feel like it's a little bit of a, am I on the right foot or not? Because I want to show that young person that I'm not just the smiley, handshaking Mr. Hall, but I'm also going to notice and connect with him in some way. Maybe it's my body language. Maybe it's my tone of voice that I use. Maybe just taking a bit of a moment. And then I might ask the young man, where would you like to sit? Or do you want to sit down? Or should we stay standing up? And kind of notice and connect in a way that shows that maybe I'm a little bit more trustworthy than some of the other people that he's met who just kind of roll over his experience and want to just focus on mom and dad's view of him. So there's so many of these small micro transactions that we know go into creating a good, trusting relationship. And they come naturally, I think, when you have close friendships and close connections in your life. But in establishing that first step in a therapeutic, you know, so-called therapeutic connection, I think paying attention to those subtle, subtle details can be so important for some people.
I completely agree. And I really try to read that. I've often come out to families, and usually the family has contacted me because they have a son or a daughter or somebody who's in crisis, and they want me to meet with their child or adult child, and that person doesn't really want to. So I often, when I come, I say, well, you know, we won't talk about that person, but make sure that we're in the room and that the person can hear the conversation. And very often, the second or third time, they start to join to give that possibility. I've also, and I'm sure you must also experience that, but in terms of being able to disclose things that they wouldn't normally do, because psychiatrists often told them that that's a really bad symptom or stuff like that. And the fact that we've been, both of us have been in psychiatry, and I'm very clear that I don't support the way the psychiatric system works. I will have nothing to do with forced admissions or you know, drugs. In fact, I help many people off their drugs, which I know you also do. So there's an authenticity which we have been given. I'm thinking of you, including you in this one. An authenticity because we've been there. We've been in the psychiatric system and found a way out, and can see it for what it is.
It's in some ways it's such a common sense thing. I mean, people want to connect and form a close relationship with people who have similar experiences with them and who can understand where they're coming from. And it's a huge, huge thing. And I very much you know, value what you're saying about, you know, not forcing people into treatment. I mean, that's a deal that if people want, you know, if that's their choice or they want to have a crisis plan or they want, but I will make an agreement with them that no, I'm not going to be the person who, you know, calls the police or calls the hospital. And that is a huge trust building piece. And also I'm not going to break confidentiality. You know, people talk to me about crimes. They talk to me about very heavy violence situations, you know, and I'm not going to break confidentiality. And there are so many, because I want them to have somewhere to go. I don't want them to be isolated with those things, and I can be the person that they can go to and help them work through these kind of sometimes really scary kind of situations. And, you know, in the US that is very difficult to do as a licensed therapist. And that's why I chose this kind of middle ground of calling myself a counselor. I don't do the insurance billing, but so many people value that, and they don't want those kinds of constraints that the therapeutic profession puts on people. So, you know, one question that I think comes up is that you and I are both very much involved in the peer support movement, and I've worked to create support groups, and I've worked to do trainings and develop community organizations around, you know, just people just finding each other in the community and offering friendship and connection and peer advocacy and just listening spaces in hearing voices groups and support groups and Freedom Center and the Icarus Project. And so one of the things that comes up is like, well, wait a second, why are you now a therapist? Isn't therapy just this, you know, horrible power imbalance? Isn't it just part of the system? Don't people just need to find each other in the community? And what would your response be to that kind of criticism of therapy in its entirety?
Therapy isn't for everyone. In fact, therapy can also be really harmful, I think, for some people. You know, if you're not respectful of people's boundaries or things like that. But there's also that element. I've also met that one that, you know, why should we pay you? Which is, you know, of course, in many ways, a very relevant question. I offer a couple of free make that assessment. And then for some people who don't have much money, I do offer a cheaper rate.
I do the same thing. I mean, I charge standard rates, but that helps me to subsidize the sliding scale, the lower rates. And it sounds like both you and I have a strategy where we're, or an approach, I would say, that we're both, you know, working in private practice, but we're also very much involved in the community development work and the movement and working with people in contexts outside of therapy. And I think that's a hugely instructive for anyone who's in this profession. You can't just be doing individual therapy and expect to actually be supporting people. People need a range of possibilities, and therapy isn't for everybody, and it's not available for everybody. And creating community support networks and places that people can go is really crucial. And there's, you know, that question kind of comes up, well, wait a second, you know, I'm paying you, so, you know, the feelings that you have for me must not be real. You don't really care for me. You know, it's because I'm paying you. You know, I mean, it's kind of like prostitution, or kind of like, you know, like paying somebody for a religious service or something. It's not really heartfelt.
I appreciate this thinking, and I've often found it that there's behind it is a huge desire to be acknowledged for who one is, just for the sake of, I like you because you are you. You know, so when people are saying, you know, you don't really like me because, you know, I'm paying you or something like that, I often try and explore that a bit more. What is behind that? What is the feeling? And often it is this lack of self-worth and the belief that people really could possibly like, that one is likable.
I mean, I think that it also speaks to what kind of person should be in this profession. If you don't genuinely find people interesting, if you don't genuinely find yourself enriched and nourished by getting close to people, then you probably don't, you know, want to be working as a therapist. And I think, unfortunately, there's a lot of people in the field that are kind of like that. They, you know, I think that one of the problems that people get into as therapists is that they have not actually done their own self-exploration work enough. They maybe haven't been in therapy themselves, or they haven't really confronted some of the things inside of themselves. And so they think, okay, I'm going to be a psychiatrist, or I'm going to be a psychologist or a therapist or something, and then I'm going to help those people. And I think that's very off-putting. It creates an us-them dynamic, and it really undermines any kind of real relationship. And then, yeah, people are going to start to resort to control and judgment, and they're not going to be able to find that genuineness.
Actually, when I think back of it, I had to unlearn everything about people to learn that they were ill, that the way they expressed themselves was signs of illness, that everything that they were doing and saying was signs of illnesses, various kinds.
Yeah, you just have to totally get out of sight of that. That's the entire clinical gaze, and it means you're relating to the manuals and the textbook. You're not actually trying to understand the person's experience. I mean, what I've seen is everything that someone does that seems psychotic or disturbed or difficult, wow, if you explore it, it makes perfect sense. It's there for a reason. It comes out of a life story. And that's how you inhabit the other person's world, is understand, why is this working for the person? Why does this actually make sense for this person to hear voices? Why does it make sense for this person to drop out of school or to be in such a state of distress that they can't take care of themselves? Or why are they so defensive and mistrustful that they can't sustain relationships? Oh, okay, yeah, there's a good reason for this. This makes a lot of sense that this person is going through this.
Exactly. And when I think back on that time, it was a very boring way to view work. And I often say to people now when I meet them, and student nurses and student, you know, and I say, be curious. I mean, and if you start to work with people's lives and what's happened, you know, rather than what's wrong kind of idea, but you know, it's much more interesting. I think it's like, I often think of myself as a detective, because I try and work out along with that, with the person who's come to me, you know, how does this fit in? What is this? What are the symbolisms, the signs, the meanings? The how does it relate to your life? How can you regain power, and get hold of your dreams? Get out of a system that's probably crushed you partially, at least. I'm so incredibly grateful to the people who come to me, because they say that they appreciate coming to me, but I also really appreciate they come to me because I learn something new every time. They are teaching me as much. I mean, I've had my story, my own story, and figuring that out and working through that. But it is such a gift to be able to learn from other people's stories, and especially if I'm so privileged as to be part of the detective work, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. And I didn't realize it at the time, but when I was doing support group work for many, many years in Massachusetts, and then also in Portland, and working with the Icarus Project and Freedom Center, that was really my training to be a counselor, because that was where I was learning, by listening to people's experience and deep, deep listening. And then also recognizing that, in any relationship, you're going to learn by listening to the other person, but you're also going to learn about yourself. You have to have curiosity towards yourself, because it's gonna change you. If I wasn't in a mutual process of growth and healing and learning, I don't think I could do what I do as a therapist. And I think that's a very difficult failing of therapy as a profession, where it puts one person above the other and says, okay, I'm like an ideal. I'm a model. You hear this sometimes. You be a model for your clients. I'm a model of someone who's healed. I'm a model of someone who's figured this out. I've done my analysis. Now you're doing yours. And then it creates this one down, and then the person just looks up at the other person, rather than recognizing that, all relationship is mutual. And I'm going to explore. I'm genuinely, when I talk with someone about their suicidal feelings, I'm genuinely interested in what is going on, because I'm going to learn more about what it is to be suicidal and what it is to be a human being. And then that's going to help me not only with the next person that I work with, but also with myself and the part of me that's suicidal. I think that one of the biggest practices I think that therapists can do is always try and find what's going on with the other person. Try and find it inside of yourself, even if it's just a little bit, and be able to find a commonality. And I think that would be a huge revolution in the field of psychotherapy and psychiatry and psychiatric nursing, if we could just allow the person who's the so-called healed one, who's the healer, who's in the position of authority, if we could allow them to be wounded and to be also open about their struggles. And so that because we're all peers as humans, we all have struggles in one form or another. Maybe you haven't been suicidal, but you've certainly felt in moments like you wanted to give up or couldn't keep going, and to really recognize that, by bringing in our own woundedness and our own vulnerability and our own stories as clinicians and as therapists, that I think strengthens the relationship and makes that connection, and then creates that mutuality and that sense of this, we're in this together, that people really, really need.
I agree. And I've also been thinking, I've noticed that I am less fearful. I'm not frightened when people talk of suicide. And I also respect that some people will commit suicide. I think it's important to be able to talk about these issues. But I remember when I used to be working as a psychiatric nurse in the system, you just had to say the S word, and everything was, oh my gosh, right? And it's because they're under also pressure, and they're also been like the patients that come into the system are institutionalized. So are the staff. We don't talk about that very often, but you do become institutionalized, and there's a lot of fear there. And so, people who hear voices, if the voices are talking about you're a bad person or things like that, staff can better deal with it. But if they hear somebody saying their voices are telling them to sexually abuse children, that freaks people out,
freaks
right?
people out, or to kill somebody. Or
kill somebody, yes, exactly.
Really what we can offer other people is the fact that we're just not as afraid. People can come to us and they can find some kind of sanctuary and some kind of refuge to talk about things with someone who's not going to freak out and get afraid. And I mean, certainly I have some fear sometimes, but it's not this overwhelming kind of fear response that's going to drive me to just grab at whatever I've been taught or told is the right thing. It reminds me of a bad experience that I've had many bad experiences with therapists, but reminds me of one where I got a referral through my friend. I trusted my friend. She says, okay, this therapist is great. I had to drive a long way to see her. This was when I was in Massachusetts after I had dropped out of graduate school. And I told her that I was hearing voices. And she said, well, you know, put a pen in your left hand and write out what the voice is saying. And I had never done this before, so I took the pen and in my left hand, I wrote out what I was hearing the voice saying, and I handed it to her. And then I had another session scheduled, and before the next session, she called me, and she says, "Will, you know, I'm sorry, but I'm not going to be able to meet with you next time. I made a mistake. My practice is full." And I okay, and then I called her back and I said, "Wait a second, is your practice really full?" And she acknowledged that no, her practice wasn't full. She just couldn't help me. And it was such an incredibly abusive thing to invite someone to open up. And then when they open up and then shut them down just because you're afraid of what is inside of them. Because the message that I got was that I'm a hopeless monster. I can't even get help from therapy. I need to just go back into the psychiatric system. And I think that those kind of, betrayals and those kinds of breaks in trust and those moments when the fear of the therapist runs the show are extremely damaging to people, just drive people into isolation. And it really hurt me a long time. And there are times when I do see a therapist now, and, every single time I have memories come up and I get flashbacks and I have my trauma responses and I go through my mistrust and my struggle. And because I know now that where it comes from, it's so deep, that wounding is so deep, the sense of betrayal, the abuse that happened from the helpers, from the therapist is so deep. And it just drives people away from getting help. I think the really key thing that a therapist or any kind of helper needs to have is to just be able to drop the defensiveness around your mistakes and really listen. And wow, this person is coming at me really strong, saying that I screwed up. Then I need to listen to them and just really explore the truth in this and then be able to acknowledge it. And sometimes that's what people need to build that trust, is like, you make a mistake, you're human, you don't hide behind, I'm the therapist, you're the patient, oh, this is just your borderline, or this is just your paranoia, or we're turning it around. Well, why are you so interested in my mistake? Why are you so, starting to analyze the other person instead of the therapist saying, wow, you're right, I screwed up, I don't feel good about that. What can we do to address this? And I think that's where I think a lot of therapists, have to have some humility and to recognize you can't do it by the book. You can't just do the right evidence-based, approach. You have to really be a human being, which means being vulnerable and, being exposed and feeling some embarrassment or humiliation, or just feeling like, wow, you messed up, and you're still in this relationship with the person and you have a commitment to them. Olga, do you want to just maybe tell us a little bit about maybe some of the experiences that you've had working with people, maybe some of the stories from some of your clients?
I work a lot with people with what we call psychosis and schizophrenia and stuff. And sadly, I'm so far, at least in Denmark, the only one working in private practice that is working with that, because I don't know, lots of places, there's a lot of fear about that. There's one story I can share of a family that came. They had an appointment with a psychiatry with a young girl. I think she was maybe 14 or something, and she was hearing voices, and they'd heard about maybe you could do something different, and she came, and they came to me, and we talked, and all the time I could hear the parents with it's psychiatry, and we actually connected, and the girl and myself, and we're talking about the voices and things like that. But And I was desperate for them to not take her to psychiatry. I often get that, and you know, people come just sort of swing by to get an idea, and some stay, thank goodness, because what I say is, give me 6 months. If that doesn't work, I at least haven't, you know, harmed in that sense with chemicals and stuff. And then, you know, some people choose that. But I remember this particular girl, and they left, and it was quite a number of years later. I met the mother who just fell, you know, around, hung onto my neck crying and said, "You don't know how many times I regret that we didn't listen to you." Because no, she was in an institution, yes, living there. And I'd given her a little Native American stone thing. And the mom said that every night she puts that under her pillow. It made me so, so sad. She was now in a long-term institution, bare on tons of medication stuff. So that's one of the, you know, so that actually really sort of, oh, that's so sad when that happens. But, you know, that also highlights the fact that when people come, I say to them, you know, it's you and me and pretty much not anybody else, because I work differently. I don't believe in these diagnoses. I don't believe in brain defects and stuff. You know, that's kind of fearful, because often families are bombarded by their surroundings. Oh, you know, take them to psychiatry and stuff.
Do you find that it also works the other way sometimes, that a family might come to you and all they need is that reassurance that they shouldn't go?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and then you've helped them choose door number two instead of door number one, and then things just go in a totally different way.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I remember with one a kid actually who heard voices and was beginning to have, you know, the voices were disturbing to her. I think she was about 9 or something like that. They were very, you know, fearful for her and stuff. And we were talking, and when the mother came and the father came one time, but I spend always a lot of time with the parents in the beginning, calming them down, because their fear infects their children. And I remember it turned out that this little girl had been the last one to talk to her uncle, the brother of the mother, I think it was. And he'd committed suicide. And being, I think that's quite common, they wanted to protect the child. So they didn't want to talk about the suicide and all these sort of things. But, you know, as a child, you pick up awful lot of things. And she also picked up how sad her mother was at the loss of her brother, right? So she had the idea that because she was the last person to have seen him, or thought she had been, it was her fault. And so the voices had come and stuff. And when we started to talk, when they actually started to talk about this, and the mother realized what was going on, it was so healing to see how suddenly, by opening that dialogue and assuming, oh my goodness, of course I can't hide things, or you know, overprotect my child and try and hide my pain and sorrow and open up for, oh, but you weren't the last, because she wasn't the last person to have seen him. She thought she had been. So in many ways, how easy, if you look at it in that sense, right? But also how huge it is and how difficult it is. And if it had been the traditional system, they might never have asked, because you're assuming that, you know, okay, you got voices. Because she didn't dare to talk really about the uncle, because she knew it upset the mother. But it was only because the mother in the therapy session mentioned it, and I became curious about what had happened. And
the daughter was really suffering partly around this belief that she was the last person to see the uncle, but they had never talked about it. And just because of the fear, and then the mom is trying to protect the daughter by not talking about it. And then when they talk about it, this connection happens and some new information comes in, and the daughter realizes, wait a second, I wasn't the last one to see him. And I can let go of that belief and that guilt. And yeah, just the power of listening, and so much, especially when we're working with very young people, but it can be also adults, but especially young people and adolescents, you know, it's got to be the family involved. You know, it's not just the young person is picking up things that are happening in the bigger social group. It's not just something inside of the head or the neurochemistry of the young person. It's, you know, it's connected to the relationships with the parents and the relationships of the family as a whole. But no one has really created that container for listening, and because there's so much fear around it.
Exactly. And one of the things I often say is, because I really do believe, you know, people see me, what, an hour a week or whatever, and they have all the other hours in their life with the people who mean something to them. And so, you know, I'm a big believer in working, I'm a complete believer in working with the network, if at all possible. And I often say to people, you know, if the family was the problem or is the problem, then the family is also the place, you know, the people that can be part of the healing. And if they weren't part of the problem, they can still obviously be a part of the...
There's usually more than just one person in distress. The one person may have a diagnosis, but the whole family, you know, is suffering, and the whole family or the whole social group needs help. And, I think this also comes to something I think is important, is that I'm doing this, and I know that you're doing this too, is that hopefully people, you know, will get what they need and then find their support and their connection actually in their community or in their family or in their social group, and not be going to therapy and kind of like, okay, do we really need you to come to me as a therapist to talk about what's going on, or who in your life can you talk to, and be rebuilding those connections? Because I think that's what happens a lot, is that, you know, society's become so isolated and fast paced that people just don't have the social supports and the closeness. And then how can you help the person to rebuild that, so they're not coming to a therapist for that, but they've got the kind of their own resources established and their own capacity to really. And that's when I think the community healing, because I think really the locus of healing is really the community. It's not individuals. It's really about starting to move society in a different direction towards more listening and more caring.
This whole idea of this individualization thing, that where the focus of the problem is inside you. No, it is always pretty much between people and the network and what's happening in people's lives. And I think it's one of the biggest tragedies that we have a system that is so fundamentally flawed that it insists on an illness explanation and trying to align itself with a, like, broken legs or appendicitis or Parkinson's, where it doesn't have that. And that is truly harmful for many.
Olga, we don't have much time remaining. Give people your contact information and your website so they can get in touch with you.
People can get in touch with me on my website, which is called Psycovery, and it's spelled psycovery.com.
Olga Runciman, thank you so much for joining us today on Madness Radio.
And thank you for inviting me. Thank you for our conversation. I enjoyed that very much.
You've been listening to an interview with Olga Runciman. Olga is a psychiatric nurse in Denmark and has worked in long-term psychiatric institutions. She's a psychiatric survivor diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia, and today she works as a psychologist in private practice. That's all the time we have on Madness Radio. Thanks for tuning in. You've been listening to Madness Radio, voices and visions from outside mental health. Madness Radio host is Will Hall. Producer is Nina Packabush. Madness Radio is an affiliate of Mad in America Radio, broadcasting on KBOO in Oregon, sponsored by Portland Hearing Voices and the Icarus Project, and syndicated on the Pacifica Network. Madness Radio is online at kboo.fm/madnessradio and at madinamerica.com.